You're listening to the Hammershed Podcast. Welcome to episode 5 of the Hammershed Podcast. I'm your host, Greg Gottfried. In today's episode, I talk with Dr. Daryl Cochran. Daryl is a strength and conditioning coach, exercise physiologist, and lecturer at Massey University. Daryl's research interest is in sport performance, and he has published a number of research articles on vibration exercise. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Daryl Cochran. Again, welcome, Daryl. Thanks for coming on. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what your background is and what you're doing at Massey University?
Well, thanks, Greg, for giving me the opportunity. So I work currently at Massey University in New Zealand. I have a PhD in sports science, and I lecture here, teaching undergraduate and postgraduate courses. My sort of fitness background has been in team sports. I have played a lot of field-based hockey, and I have represented New Zealand in field indoor hockey. Sort of come from strength background as well as metabolic training for my own purposes of being an athlete. And also professionally, I've worked as a strength and conditioning coach for elite athletes in New Zealand and Olympic athletes. So being a sort of an academic, but also having done my own sporting performance plus training others, has given me a good eclectic range of ideas and methods that I've come across over the years. So that's a bit about me. I guess how I got interested in vibration training was that at the time when I was training some elite athletes, a professor here at Massey University was looking at vibration in horses, and he's looking at whether it would be pertinent for athletes, etc. And we sort of teamed up through that, and I started using the machine as a conditioning machine for those particular athletes. Not in isolation, but in conjunction with what they were doing, to see if the claims of increasing strength and power, etc., were true. And so I did some pilot work with that and got some reasonable results, but it wasn't controlled because I didn't have a control group. And then things just stemmed from there, basically, and the rest is history here.
So for the people who aren't familiar with vibration training or whole body vibration, can you give us a brief description of what it exactly is?
Yeah, okay. So whole body vibration, there's different types. So basically, the normal procedure is that you stand on a plate. And standing on a plate, the plate will either vibrate up and down, and that will create vibration through the body. So That is one method. The other method is the plate will move from side to side. So a bit like a seesaw where you've got a fulcrum in the middle, and the plate will move side to side at high speeds of vibration. So normally in vibration training, what we're trying to do is the application of rhythmical oscillation from the platform of the machine in which the feet stand on. So basically, vibration training is a form of an acceleration type of training to increase the force on the muscular skeletal system. So basically, what you're trying to do is add more gravity or G-forces to the body. So whole body vibration machines, normally you stand on, but there's other handheld vibration dumbbells you can also purchase. And there's other equipment that you can attach to strength training equipment to make cables vibrate, etc. So the one that is there at the moment is the vibration plate that you stand on.
And I remember those being referred to in two different types, the vertical vibration, and that's the one that goes up and down. And yes, is it horizontal, yep, the one that's the seesaw type?
Yeah, so horizontal. So In the research, we call the one that goes side to side as side alternating, and the one that moves up and down is known as synchronized. But yeah, there's different terms out there in layman's talk as well. So yeah, so vertical or horizontal, basically.
Okay. What are some of the claimed benefits of using vibration training?
So the biggest claim that I've seen is that probably manufacturers or they try and sell the device as a silver bullet, so a machine that does everything and it does it very quickly. So one of the claims is that a 10-minute workout on a vibration machine is equal to approximately a conventional 1-hour workout. So as you know, people lead very busy lifestyles and they're looking for a quick fix. But unfortunately, from the research I've seen and I've conducted with metabolic costs, so it's the amount of oxygen that you can inhale, and in terms of that, it doesn't seem to create enough metabolic cost to drive metabolizing fat, etc. So it's probably one of the claims on that is probably not true. And some of the research has suggested this isn't correct either. So conventional type of aerobic workout in terms of walking, running, cycling is probably far more beneficial than standing on a vibration machine to try and lose weight. Now, typically, the females who want to lose weight, etc., will jump on this machine and come off and probably feel toned. And that's probably an acute response from the increase in blood flow that's been circulating around, probably has increased what we call intramuscular pressure, and it makes you have a feeling of a toned effect. It subsides within probably 10 to 15 minutes, depending on the vibration workout that you've just done. So that's one of the claims, that it can reduce body fat fairly quickly, which I don't think has been proven in the research field. Although there has been a couple of studies that would suggest otherwise, but it's not clear in the research area. The other claims that it does is that it can increase leg strength, power output in terms of muscular power, etc., and increases blood flow as well. So, and there's other things like so whether it can help with recovery in terms of musculoskeletal problems. That are sort of the basic claims around that.
So you pull one of these out from underneath your bed, you plug it in, you turn it on, stand there for 10 minutes, and you're magically lost all your fat, and you are stronger too.
That is the claim.
Right.
But I don't think that is possible, because it just doesn't generate enough metabolic cost on the muscle per se. Most of these machines, like side alternating machine, goes up to 30 hertz. The vertical up and down goes up to 50 hertz. And normally you either do an intermittent protocol or continuous protocol. And I don't think you could go longer. And I've done this. I've spent half an hour on one, and it's not a really nice experience at 26 hertz. So I don't think it can generate enough metabolic cost. It's probably better to do a conventional aerobic type of program. However, there's a little caveat there that if a person has got compromised health, like they may not be able to start off on an aerobic program, etc., then the whole body vibration may allow in the first, you know, 2 to 3 months, allow some mobility back to allow them to go into an aerobic or conditioning type of program.
Now, you've done a lot of research on the subject, and I have read some of the stuff that you've had published on PubMed. I've seen a lot of things that you've tested. What kind of application is beneficial when using vibration training?
Well, definitely there's an increase in blood flow. So I haven't done this per se. It's from other colleagues that have done this, and that's quite convincing, that the blood flow does increase 200% from resting or baseline values. So people who suffer maybe from claudication, etc., that there could be benefits to them. I've sort of focused on muscle performance. So I've looked at strength, power, and sort of warm up in terms of looking at acute. That's very important when you look at the research, is what type of plate have they used, whether it's acute, so it's between pre and post measures, so a one-off, or whether it's short-term, so less than 2 months training, or where it's long-term, greater than 2 months. And most of my focus of my research has been sort of like acute effects of whole body vibration. So looking at warm-up effect, whether we can generate muscle temperature increases, and that has been shown that you can. Although I've just finished a study looking at high pulse using vibration as a mechanism to warm up for that, and it seems that it doesn't provide anything different than a conventional high pull warm up. So the muscle performance sort of regimes that have been investigated in our lab at Massey University here have also looked at, on the side, looking at compromised health, whether vibration can help in post-stroke and multiple sclerosis patients, and that's the lines of investigation.
So you mentioned warm-up as a possible benefit for this. Now, I can kind of see this as have you done any testing to where, you know, maybe for sports performance, you know, like field sports of some kind, where you've got someone sitting on the bench for 15, 20 minutes and maybe standing on that before they jump into the game, help them warm up? You said it doesn't help more, like in some of your studies, to warm up than another, but if it's something that's kind of compact, you can still be at the event and not expend as much energy warming up, but get the benefits from it.
Yeah, definitely correct. Yeah, definitely. So with that, and I think there has been a few teams, especially in the New Zealand context here, a national sport is rugby. So normally on the sidelines they have stationary cycle ergometers that the players warm up on, etc., you know, just to keep the legs ticking along.
Sure.
I have heard over in the States that they've had vibration plates on sidelines, even in soccer, etc. They've tried that out. And as you've stated, it's got a low metabolic cost, so you're not going to cause any deficits to that, but you're going to fire up the neuromuscular side of things as well. So that's the benefit of that. So it doesn't add anything in terms of its extra cost to the muscle metabolism.
You said that you've done some testing on, or maybe it was something that I read, over speed and jumping. What kind of results have you seen from using vibration training on maybe vertical leap or sprint speeds?
Yeah, so vertical leap, we found an 8% increase in elite female hockey players, and that was a study conducted way back in 2005, and that was controlled for in a lab environment, obviously. So that 8% was from a vibration protocol, and that was compared to a 70-watt stationary cycling compared to sort of a control of doing nothing, basically. And so an 8% is quite a big increase. With that, other research has reported anything between 4 and 6% increase. So the vertical jump in terms of performance has been shown to increase. So lower body muscular power, and Bosco's done in his early studies looking at leg press, etc., and found an increase in leg press power as well. So I think you can be confident to say it does help acutely in muscular leg power. And sprint speed, I've done a couple of studies, and that's not convincing at all. So no change with vibration in terms of sprint speed across 5, 10 and 20 metres. And I've just completed one study recently looking at sprint speed across initial step and then up to 2 meters. So that what I call the acceleration phase, you know, that first step, bang. And there was no difference between whole body vibration and a standard warm-up of sprint-orientated activities. So the speed area in terms of enhancement isn't convincing at all. Although some studies have indicated there is, especially in ice hockey. There's one study that has indicated that enhanced ice hockey sprint speed, but other than that, acutely, I think the jury is out at that at the moment. But definitely with the lower body power, there is substantial gains from acute exposure.
Can you talk a little bit about the methods of that vertical leap test that you did? You said that the control, they were just doing nothing. Were you took a test of their vertical leap Was that pre warm up even, or were the athlete or the subjects already warmed up before they jumped on the plate or did your initial test?
No, so basically they came into the lab and they rested for 10 minutes. So there was no warm up prior to hopping or doing the vibration, and that was like for the control as well. So it was just to make sure. Although it is quite dangerous not having a warm-up, but I wanted to mitigate any influence of a warm-up effect. So hence why they rested for 10 minutes and they were told not to run whilst coming to the lab. So transport was by car to negate any effect of a warm-up with that. The vertical jump itself, and I must indicate that because it is a well-cited study, but I don't mind saying that the vertical jump was done without hands on hips. Now, why I did that is that in other movements, you use your hands, but in scientific purposes, normally your hands have to stay on the hips to make sure that it's just the legs. But the reliability of jumping with your hands was fairly high, so I have no qualms that the vibration was the component of causing an increase. And plus, I had two other conditions as well that were randomized and counterbalanced in a way that it would have to be from the vibration and not from the jump performance.
Do you think that the performance gains could be attributed to just being warmed up better by being on the plate?
Yes, and that's what, when I did that study way back in 2005, that's what started the sort of the warm-up route in terms of what I was following research-wise, that I thought, well, are we just warming up the muscle? Are we just increasing the blood flow acutely? It may be different because I haven't done any long-term studies whether the muscle may change, etc., you know. But acutely, I think, well, is there a warm-up effect or post-potentiation occurring? So you're firing up the muscle neurologically, you're getting this increase in rapid and blood flow, you're getting an increase in muscle temperature. All of those are proponents of a warm-up effect. So hence why I continued with the research of how much does the muscle warm up if you stay on this vibration plate for 5 minutes continuously. So that led on to another study looking at muscle temperature changes within vibration. And that showed similar changes with performance and vertical jump. And in that study, we looked at looking at vibration as a warm up protocol and comparing that to a hot bath. So that's a passive, so the hot bath was set to 40 degrees water temperature, and a cycling stationary warm-up as well. And so they were metabolically similar between the cycling. So it was like, I think, roughly at 70 watts. So that was around about, I think, 25 mils per kilogram per minute, I think, from memory. And that was matched with the vibration protocol. So those two were matched for work, you could say, basically. So the vibration protocol included squatting up and down to get the same metabolic drive. And so muscle temperature went up a lot quicker compared to 70 watts of cycling. I chose 70 watts of cycling because that's sort of a standard measure we use in the lab. On reflection, you could say, well, why can't you cycle at 120 or 150 watts, you know? So, of course, that's going to drive muscle temperature up a lot quicker. So a standard 10-minute cycle warm-up, you got the same muscle temperature doing a whole body vibration in 5 minutes, whereas a water bath took 16 minutes to get the same change in muscle temperature. However, the change in vertical jump was similar across all three, so the vibration didn't add anything extra. So the take-home point was that any warm-up effect, whether it's vibration or sitting in a hot bath or stationary cycling, it's the muscle temperature that plays an important component to help performance. So I was hoping there would be a neurological component to the vibration that would extend that that performance in the vertical jump, but it didn't.
Have you done any studies comparing the two different types of vibration and if there's a big difference?
No, I, yeah. Amber Crombie has, and I think another investigator have looked at the differences between the two types of vibration plates, because they are different. And that's where it gets a little bit confusing when you read the research. So when you do read the research, make sure that you look at what type, whether it's vertical or the side to side, because they are different. And so I haven't done any studies myself, but the research would suggest that they are different.
How about you mentioned that, you know, if someone's trying to get some exercise in a short amount of time, someone's trying to lose fat by standing on one of these plates, that maybe just standing there is not going to do anything. How about exercising on top of it? What kind of benefits are there, if any?
I think this tool, and I don't work for any company, and I could be shot here, but I just do the research because I'm interested in whether it affects the end user, so whether it's for the athlete or for the general population or for a compromised health person. And I think it has to be used in tandem or in combination with our training that we do. I don't think it can be used in isolation, except if you've got a compromised health person that you need to get to a certain stage, and then they can go on to other forms of conventional exercise. So again, I haven't done any research of looking at the combination, but if you look at the long-term studies provided by my other colleagues, so looking at strength training over, you know, 5 or 6 months, that they would suggest that vibration improved lower strength parameters in the legs, but it was no difference to a conventional strength training program. And there's been another study that looked at whole body vibration, strength training, and a combination of vibration training and conventional strength training. And again, there were sort of no differences, I think, from 4 months of training with that. So I think it's up to the individual as well. And this is important as a strength and conditioning coach. You have to, again, look at the person's background, etc., and then work out what's best for their lifestyle. Of course, combining it together should give a better effect, but that may not be always the case.
All right. Now, you did mention earlier that you were looking into other benefits for different populations, such as people who suffer from multiple sclerosis, and I've seen some studies on people with diabetes. What kind of work has been done in those areas, and what are the findings?
In my research, I've just stuck to multiple sclerosis and stroke. And again, in the MS patients, we found, you know, some good changes in their ambulance walking and things like so that. And post-stroke, for those who had stroke up to 6 years from their first incidents, there wasn't much change there. I haven't really done any research in the diabetes area, and it would be an interesting focus. So I'm just unaware at the moment of what the research is suggesting in that area. I'm not too sure, again, if you can actually, obviously you're getting increase in blood flow, etc., but whether that can help diabetes is yet to be determined, I guess. Again, acutely versus short-term versus long-term needs to be investigated thoroughly, I think, in that area. You know, there's not too many short-term to long-term studies done, as I understand, in that type of area.
So it's just improvement in gait is what you have found with patients with MS working with vibration therapy?
Yes, so working in their walk speed time, so that was timed by timing gates, that improved from undertaking whole body vibration training over a short term, that is, not acutely, so up to 2 months of training. So it has benefits with that. In post-stroke, our sample size was very, very, very small, so that may have been the reason why we didn't see any changes. And it was a crossover too, so I think it has got a place in that type of area, but again, it should be complemented with conventional type of training as well. I think if you just stuck with one type of training, then, you know, muscle and the musculoskeletal system is very plastic. It adapts very quickly, and of course, as we know, strength and conditioning coaches, you need to be changing that stimulus regularly. So the vibration plate allows that in terms of changing the frequency and changing the body positions. Some of the machines, you can't change the amplitude. So on the vertical vibration plates, there is a switch that you can either go at 2 millimeters or up to 6 millimeters. And that's the amplitude, as I referred to, is how the plate moves up and down. Whereas a side-to-side plate, by positioning the feet across the plate, will change the height of the amplitude that the feet are moving under the plate. So those sort of parameters are like the parameters that we deal with when we acutely change any training principles. So the load can be further increased by putting on weighted vests, having dumbbells, barbells, etc. With that. So the progressions are there, and it's important that they're included in any long-term study with that.
Interesting. So you've done a lot of research on this. Seems like something that you're pretty interested in. How do you apply it to what you do for exercise, or do you at all?
Yes, I do. As I said earlier, I've used it in athlete training. For the athletes that I've trained, because I was interested to see if it was reputable. And again, in our setting, you know, you can never control for everything, you know, and hence why we have to go to the lab sometimes and make it controlled, but then you lose the ecological validity, you know, of what actually really happens in the real world. So I'm always at, you know, thinking, well, this happens in the real world and this happens in the lab. What can I extract from this? And so I always hope that the stuff that I can do in the lab has some pertinence to the real world. And sometimes that doesn't happen because, as we know, athletes have different training loads. They respond differently individually. And that's why we need to have a look at if different vibration frequencies and amplitudes differ across different people. And there has been a couple of publications on that where people exposed to vibration plates are exposed to different levels and have different outputs in terms of enhancement. So what may work for 30 hertz and one person may be working at 22 hertz for another. So it's those type of things. So I have implemented this into strength and conditioning programs to look at enhancing strength, speed, power output, in conjunction with conventional training. I've also used this anecdotally on an athlete that suffered an ACL injury and had come back from rehabilitation. I wasn't able to publish that because it's only on it was a case study, a sample size of one. So I've used that in terms of rehab areas and looking at cutting or agility types of movements as well, whether whole body vibration can enhance that, and looking at warm-up too in terms of can we enhance or maintain muscle temperature without exacerbating performance for the field-based athlete. I've used it myself. I've suffered lower back injury, so a herniated disc in L4 and L5, so I've experimented around that as well in conjunction with conventional training. And I've got a family member who suffers from claudication, which is my father. So he's bought a vibration machine and he did it off his own bat to help him with his claudication in terms of getting some more mobility. And we've been working through a program with him on that. So I didn't push him into the area. As I said, I don't work for any commercial companies. I just do the research to help the end user, or if it can help the end user.
Mm-hmm. Can you go into a little bit of detail of how you specifically incorporate this into the strength and conditioning programs you have for your athletes?
Yes, for sure. So basically, I always make sure that in the proper periodized training program, that and that is through their strength areas, that is that a meeting. So that's the first thing, because at the end of the day, you have to make sure that the head coach is happy with them making changes in their overall strength. And then as a supplement to that, during an unloaded week, so they may come off lifting very heavy load, etc., or maximum period of lifting, where I put them on the vibration plate as an unloading mechanism with that, and that's prescribed carefully in conjunction with the athlete and the head coach as well. Also, I've used this as a recovery tool as well, and I've produced a bit of research that suggests that doesn't help in recovery. So I've looked at this as a, and that's my just my research from that, you know, where we tried, well, we did inflict 3 sets of 100 repetitions on an isokinetic diameter. So an isokinetic diameter is just a flash machine that allows the lower limb to do the work, basically. And so they did 100 contractions, 3 sets to elicit muscle damage eccentrically. And I think, to be honest, I think maybe some of those athletes didn't really push themselves hard enough to induce muscle damage. So when we put the, when we did the vibration protocol, it probably didn't substantiate anything. So in terms of recovery, to create a sort of a mechanical massage effect, some other research has suggested it does work. Research that I've done suggests it doesn't, but it doesn't make it any worse, but there's no enhancement compared to other forms of recovery training, whether it's hot and cold contrast, using compression tights, etc. You know, so the whole area of recovery is important, and I'm about to undertake another study looking at localized vibration rather than whole body vibration. So that will be interesting to have a look at that when the results come out. So again, as a recovery tool, I've implemented that warm up. I've used that instead of using a standard strength workout or warm up effect. I've used the vibration plate as that. It's something different for the athlete, because as we know, athletes get very bored with programs sometimes, and they're looking for another stimulus. So I try and put that to supplement in a standard strength and conditioning program.
That's really fascinating. As I mentioned before the show, you know, this is something that hadn't even been on my radar until just a few weeks ago, and it seems like it's an interesting tool that has its place and can be applied in a beneficial way. But just like everything else that we run into that claims to be a magic bullet, it's not, but that doesn't mean it's not useful.
Yeah, I think you summed it up pretty well there, Greg, in terms of that. You know, it's another training tool in our training kit for strength and conditioning, you know, that can be used, supplemented in conjunction with our standard training, you know, maybe to get an athlete off a plateau. I think it has got benefits for compromised health in terms of getting people back into a mainstream program, you know. They may not be able to walk to the mailbox, but by standing on a vibration plate, they're able to increase blood flow, get some muscle contraction going. That enables them to do gross muscle contractions with that, you know. And maybe for the busy person as well, in conjunction with other things, with their strength, bone density, etc. But I'm not too sure on losing body mass. People out there listening to this, including the manufacturers, may provide and do and will provide some research that would suggest otherwise. But it's not convincing, you know. Again, you have to sum up the client and the principles of individuality, overload, frequency, all of those types of things need to be looked at when you do your program.
Sure. All right, I got 3 more quick questions, and this is something that I try to give everyone. I'm a huge proponent of goals, and I'm always trying to keep people accountable and get on the record of things that they're working on. So how about you give me what your professional goals are for 2016?
2016 goals, I guess I need to continue with 3 good publications again in the vibration area. So that would be one goal professionally, to make sure that I keep producing at least 3 outputs this year that are peer reviewed and go through that process of that. and making sure that I enjoy my work thing and making sure that it has my results are useful to the end user. And sometimes I do get lost on that, Greg, to be honest, because I do work for a university and sometimes our science blinds our application with what we're trying to do, because sometimes things are far too controlled, or we just take it too science-y and we don't have an end product that we can say to the general population or to the athlete that this is the practicalities of this, you know. So that's my goals, you know, to keep things in perspective, the science and the application, really. Yeah.
That's fantastic. I really appreciate that myself, being someone who loves the sciences. And anytime I've got a question about something, I'm always doing the research. But oftentimes I find that the research that's been done on the subject that I'm looking at is done in a way where it's not applicable to what I'm wanting to know. So I really appreciate you trying to keep us in mind when you're doing these studies.
Yeah, and it is difficult because sometimes we just look at one muscle, you know, because it's easier to do in the lab, it's easier to control, whereas in the real world, we're using multi-joints, you know, we're using a lot of muscles, we're using a lot of nervous, neural control, etc., you know, and it's difficult to do that. And I always think, am I doing enough, a good enough job here, you know?
Sure. How about fitness goals for this year? What do you want to accomplish?
Fitness goals, because I'm still playing field hockey and I play at masters levels now because I'm that old. We've got a tournament coming up in a month, so our national field hockey tournament. So for the team, I'd like us to make the top three. Personally, I've been training at the moment, so because field hockey is based on intermittent high intensity training. So I've been trying to get my speed times down. And I was never a speed and power person. I play in the midfield, so I do all the running and the donkey work for our strikers to score all the goals. So at the moment, I'm trying to get my 5 meter speed time down to at least sort of 1.05 type of thing. So, and I'm still a bit off that, to be honest. And I do a 4K time trial, well, roughly 4.5, so in roughly about 17 and a half minutes. So I want to get that down to about 17 minutes 20, so take another 10 seconds off that. So, you know, under 4 minute Ks type of thing. So 3 minutes 50 odd, 54, I think. If I can get that slightly under, I'd be pretty happy. And my strength, I'd like to increase, but with my lower back, with the bulging disc and repercussions of that, I think my maximum testing won't be attained this year. So, yeah, those are the three sort of goals I've got.
Excellent. And final question. I'm a huge music buff, so I'm always interested in hearing what people are listening to when they're working out.
Yeah, so when I work out in the gym, I don't listen to any specific music. And so it gives me a chance, believe it or not, to actually think about things. So the music in the gym that I go to, it just plays the standard music. So it's from the radio, it's contemporary music, pop, etc. You know, so that gets blurring away. I don't have any music that I play to a routine. Why? Because I find when I'm working out in the gym, some of my best thoughts are being processed during that. So it takes my mind away from the hurt at that present stage. You know what it's like?
Yeah.
And I think, oh, I never thought about that idea. And that's how some of my creativity comes about when I'm designing research, etc., or looking at how I can do things better. Whilst when I'm doing 4K time trials or I'm out doing shuttles or high-intensity running work, same sort of things, although probably not so more when I'm doing repetitions of 200s or 400s because I hurt, but probably more so when I'm on a 4 or even 7K, 8K run, I let my mind sort of drift and think about creative sides of things. So I guess it's the hormones kicking in a little bit, you know, to create that feeling of euphoria, and then those creative thoughts comes for more. So I've I don't use music per se, believe it or not, only when I'm in the gym and maybe when I'm doing a treadmill interval workout. So again, that's just radio, stereo music coming from there. So it's just contemporary and pop music.
That's funny.
Take the pain away.
It's interesting that you're the second person that has said that this month. where I personally found, and I said this when I was talking to Neil, the last person that said this, that I also feel like I get a lot of creativity and I'm able to think really well when I'm exercising, although I need the music to kind of filter out everything else. It keeps the pain out of my mind and allows me to think about things.
Yeah, definitely. I can relate to that, you know, definitely. And it's probably on my longer runs that I probably get that more so. But sometimes when I'm in the gym, things come about too, you know. And I can certainly see why people have a lot of different type of ranges of music too. Pre-warm-up music, you know, etc. to get them into flow, you know, it's that mental state as well, isn't it? You know, psychologically it helps you. So I can certainly understand, but I've never used music per se. You know, I let my mind wander a little bit for creativeness.
Well, I'll have to give it a try sometime.
Everyone's different, aren't they?
Yeah. I really, really appreciate your time today. Thanks for sharing with me all the work that you've done. Where can people find what you're doing and more information, or more good information on vibration training?
Yeah, so I think PubMed is a good way to look at the research, or you can go to my Massey staff page, and it's got the research published there. So Daryl Cochran, if you go to www.massey.ac.nz, School of Sport and Exercise, and click under staff, you'll find me there and the research I've published there, and that will take you to that. But as you've done, Greg, and it's good to hear that you've gone through PubMed, which is always good, and not through the flashy websites that always claim things, you know. But as you've said today, also you need to be careful when you do read the research about what's being done, what the protocols are, etc. So you do need to be savvy in that as well. And sometimes we do write in scientific jargon, and that's just the way it is. But normally a conclusion or something at the end, or even the abstract, will help the reader if you're not too au fait with scientific jargon, because it is very, it can be frightening when you read something. Oh my goodness, I don't even understand this. What's the take-home message here, you know? And it's difficult sometimes in a scientific journal to do that. So there's not too many other avenues except for glossy magazines that we can go to get our practitioner's point of view across.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, I hope you have a great day, and maybe sometime we can get you back on and talk some more about new research you've done.
Thanks, Greg, for giving me the opportunity. It's been a great talking to you, and I hope you can get something out of this, and hopefully the listeners can make an informed decision on themselves too. So thanks for taking the time too out of your day.
Absolutely. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. To find out more about the Hammershed podcast or to sign up for online coaching, check us out at hammershed.com. And be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, consistency is king.